So thank you very much, President Rigobano. Thank you for the high honor of addressing you and your colleagues today. I'm calling you from my home in the west of Ireland with many, many links to the United States. And we always intuit that we are always stronger together as we look across the ocean. I was very moved by Reverend Fry's invocation that we should reach out and try and impact the world. And my talk very much follows in his spirit. I've often said that the UN treaty without the United States is like Hamlet without the prince. There's such a natural fit. I think there's so much you could do with it, and there's so much we could do with you being present in it. Nearly all the issues you mentioned, President Rigobano, in your wonderful speech, resonate very strongly with the jurisprudence of the UN Disability Treaty. And as Secretary Buttigieg said, people want to belong to the economy, to society, and to their culture, and we all need them to belong. And the UN Disability Treaty is an incredibly powerful instrument in leveraging change to make sure that happens. In the brief time available, I just want to do three things, and I will not descend into legalities or niceties. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about the background to the treaty. As you yourself mentioned, President, it's one of the most widely ratified treaties in the world. 182 countries, ranging from every single corner in the world, have now ratified, including your neighbor up north, Canada, and your neighbor down south, Mexico. So I want to just briefly describe what the treaty mechanism is, what kind of implementation and monitoring mechanism is available under the treaty. It's important to understand it does not exist in isolation. It's part of a number of global mechanisms, but it's at the heart of those global mechanisms. So really, if you want to have an impact around the world, you have to be part of the CRPD, influencing all those other global mechanisms. Secondly, and very briefly, I just want to highlight some of the substantive innovations in the treaty that are generally applicable to all persons with disabilities, and even intersectionally available to, for example, older people with disabilities, women and children, etc. And there are some provisions in the treaty that have a special relevance to citizens with visual impairments, and I'll explain momentarily. And then thirdly, I just want to anticipate the future a little bit and maybe pose the question, why join? Why ratify? What's in it for you? And I think there are some tangible benefits in it for you. And how can you use it for the benefit of others around the world? So first things first, if I can get my computer to work. Okay. The interesting thing about the drafting of the treaty is that there were draft versions available in the 1980s, just as you were considering drafting the Americans with Disabilities Act. In fact, Sweden and Italy produced drafts in the mid-1980s. The Swedish draft was produced by Bengt Lindqvist, very, very famous blind lawyer in Sweden at the time. It didn't go anywhere at the time, but it set the table for what was going to happen in the next 10, 15 years. When we began drafting the treaty, we widely assumed, everybody assumed, it would be like the Americans with Disabilities Act, an equal opportunities treaty, but now instead of confined to the US or the UK or Australia or Canada, projected out onto a global level. But something really interesting happened in drafting the treaty. A lot of the disability groups were present, and part of the richness of the treaty is due to their presence during the negotiations, said, hang on a minute, the reason why we need these elaborate equality protections is you're not treating us seriously as persons. And that's why there's some fascinating, innovative provisions on the convention on personhood, on your autonomy, on your right to be the self, as the slogan for your organization goes, the right to live your life your way. And that morphs into other things like the right to live independently and the right to have your voice heard individually as well as collectively. Many people say, and I say, this is actually the heart of the convention, revealing the person behind the mask, so to speak, and getting others to treat personhood seriously. The second interesting thing that happened is we took the equality theory embedded in the ADA and in UK legislation, Canadian legislation, and then broadened it and deepened it. And I'll talk momentarily about that because it's very important and applies throughout the convention. By the way, the convention mingles or co-mingles civil and political rights, like the right to vote, inclusive education, the right to protection from violence and exploitation, with economic, social, and cultural rights, the right to inclusive education, the right to health, and so on and so forth. Importantly to note, where this doesn't exist in a country, it doesn't necessarily force it to exist, but it helps to shape it where it does exist to make sure that if you have an elaborate social security system, that it genuinely supports people and does not entrap them and so forth. We could get into some niceties and technicalities here, but I'll try and avoid that for the moment. Also very important, and the US had a leadership role in this, but maybe others have now taken that leadership role. The treaty applies both to your domestic policy and to your foreign policy. And that would include your development assistance programs around the world. If you can't build inclusive schools in the United States, you certainly should not be using taxpayers' dollars to build non-inclusive schools in Africa and so forth. The EU disability strategy, just published 2 months ago, now has a whole section on the European Union in the world. That is to say, based on the UN Disability Treaty, helping other countries to meet standards of the UN Disability Treaty. So the European Union is in the process of becoming a preeminent champion of disability rights worldwide. Personally, I would love to see an alliance between the European Union and the United States in this regard, maybe a new transatlantic alliance. Also, very important to note in the history of the drafting of the treaty, the World Federation of the Blind, led by Kiki Nordstrom from Sweden, and the World Federation of the Deaf were present and very active during the drafting of the convention. And they managed to ensure that some of the articles, for example, dealing with inclusive education, took specific account of the learning needs of blind students, as well as deaf students, as well as deaf-blind students. And they also collaborated in drafting Article 9 on the right to accessibility. This is not in any other UN treaty. This is specific to this particular treaty and is very important. And in fact, there was a complaint already, an individual complaint to the UN treaty body on inaccessible ATM machines in Spain. And the complaint was won. It's a process under what's called an optional protocol. So if the US ratifies the treaty, it also has the option of opting into the complaints mechanism if it wants to do so. And about two thirds of all of the countries that have ratified the convention have in fact done so. Sorry, my computer is giving me problems as usual. So moving on. What are the treaty mechanisms? I think it's very important to distinguish between international level treaty mechanisms and domestic treaty mechanisms. At the international level, there is now what's called a UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. What it does sounds pretty boring, but it's actually pretty important. It assesses government reports. Every 4 years, your government comes forward with a comprehensive report. And it arrives at conclusions and recommendations to the government based on that report. If your government has opted into the optional protocol, it can additionally receive complaints from individuals and groups. Because you have not ratified the treaty, you cannot nominate somebody to sit on this body. And that's very unfortunate, I would have thought. Nor do you get a chance to vote for who gets to be elected on that committee. Now, so far, there have been some very eminent blind lawyers and other blind activists on the committee. And in fact, the very first chair is a very eminent blind lawyer from Sydney in Australia, Ron McCallum. The point is the US, because it hasn't ratified, is not allowed to nominate its own member and therefore lacks influence over the direction of the committee and isn't even allowed to vote for others who are being put forward by the states themselves. That's just one layer. Another layer is what's called the Conference of States Parties. This is where all 182 states that have ratified the treaty meet once a year for an extended period for conversations, global conversations on challenges, and more importantly, on solutions, sharing solutions with each other. Again, unfortunately, you cannot be part of that, or at least a formal part of it, unless and until you ratify. That's probably the single most important global platform for conversations on disability law and policy. I won't belabor you with most of the other detail, but just be aware that the UN specialized agencies, for example, UNESCO, the ILO, you were mentioning issues about remuneration, the ILO is very engaged on that, and other bodies like the World Intellectual Property Organization, they're all now influenced by the CRPD. In fact, there is a UN disability inclusion strategy only put together 2 years ago, exclusively driven by the UN CRPD, the UN Disability Treaty. The US, of course, is a member of these specialized agencies, but the agenda is not set there, it's set by the UN Disability Treaty. And again, I think you're kind of missing out on the center of gravity in global conversations. Also, there are annual discussions in the UN General Assembly and the UN Human Rights Council on disability issues, where other countries like Canada, New Zealand, and Mexico now take the lead. I won't go into my role, which is rather detailed, but I will say that I do put a spotlight on challenging issues and produce two reports a year. The first one is going to be on war, conflicts, and peace building and disability. And the second one is actually going to be on artificial intelligence, the risks, as well as some of the opportunities into the future. So the international layer is quite complex, but I think it can be crunched down into the treaty body, the conference of states parties that meet once a year, and then the other agencies in the UN system. Just as important, the treaty imagines that there will be a domestic institutional architecture to drive change. This is very unusual. Other treaties don't do this. And the drafters of the disability treaty said, we can have stuff out there in the pure ether of international law, but unless there's a way of owning it domestically, it's not actually going to drive change. And that's why the treaty requires states that ratify to have in place a clear focal point within government to drive change, a right to be consulted among civil society with government. We call this the co-production of policy into the future between power and voice. And then ideas are the input of third parties like your US Civil Rights Commission, National Council on Disability, and so forth. So the image here is a triangular image of for change between power and government, voice and civil society, and the power of ideas driving imaginative blueprints for change. That's one of the key drivers for change around the world. And where it's working well, you know that that golden triangle has actually kicked in. So it's like, as it were, a vehicle for internalizing the values of the convention. What about some of the substantive innovations? And I'll be very, very brief here. I mentioned personhood and the anchoring of the convention on personhood. Let me say that that ripples out into all sorts of interesting policy domains and challenges. One of them has to apply, for example, to the future of mental health policy. And the trend now that's very pronounced internationally toward non-coercive models for mental health. And the WHO just 2 weeks ago published an amazing compendium of good practice from around the world, away from traditional civil commitment ideals. And that really is kind of personhood ideas coming to life in that particular domain. I mentioned equality too. And of course, the convention is very much beholden to an equality theory or vision. But, and here's the important but, it's broader and deeper than the equality idea, for example, in the British disability discrimination legislation, in the Australian legislation, or in the American legislation. The UN treaty body has adopted what it calls a theory of inclusive equality. This resonates with what Secretary Buttigieg was saying early on. So it's not just about measuring relativities of treatment between me and somebody else. It's much deeper than that. The committee says it's based primarily on recognition of you as a person. It's based on accommodation of the difference of disability and a recognition of accumulated disadvantages from the past. It's also based on notions of a diversity of disability. And last but not least, very, very interesting for us in Europe, maybe slightly less for you in the United States, it also has to do with the need to re-engineer social supports to make sure they liberate and do not entrap people into the future. That's a huge challenge for us in Europe. I can't speak to the United States. So the personhood stuff is important, the equality stuff is important, that it applies across the board to all of the substantive rights like political participation. There's an image of active citizenship, participation, and inclusion in the convention that cuts through everything. Also, the right to accessibility was added in Article 9. And one of the very first things the UN treaty body did was produce an extensive commentary, I beg your pardon, on what Article 9 means, particularly in the context of the electronic environment. And as I say, some of the complaints that have gone to the committee have dealt with this. What you, I'm sure you're aware of, the Marrakesh Treaty in the NFB. The interesting thing to note is that the Marrakesh Treaty, which relaxes copyright in favor of blind readers, would not exist without the CRPD. The CRPD created the spur for the drafting of the Marrakesh Treaty. You in the United States have at least signed Marrakesh. I'm not sure if you've ratified, but Marrakesh is an offspring of the CRPD. It's not the mothership itself. The mothership itself is actually the CRPD. So what about the future? And I will stop here for sake of time. We have a saying here in my country, if you're not in, you can't win. So you're not really at the heartbeat of changes internationally unless you're formally a part of the actual convention itself. So the question you really should be asking you now is it worth it going again back to the Senate? And if so, what argumentative strategies should be used? I'm an outsider, but I have observed your process in recent years. I think the argument used last time around for ratification, well, they obviously didn't work. It was based on a supposition that the treaty affirms everything in US law, and that the treaty helps project the ADA onto the international sphere, giving Americans the same rights abroad as at home. Well, those arguments clearly didn't work. I would personally say that the CRPD builds on and then complements existing US law. It doesn't break it. It's like the ADA second generation. It just extends its imaginative horizons. A treaty, any treaty, is an act of sovereignty. It's not a time bomb to override sovereignty. And even if there was something ugly that eventuated in the future from it, you can still exercise your sovereign rights to withdraw from the treaty in the future, although I wouldn't like to see that happen. All states enter into treaties in good faith. We call that pacta sunt servanda. It doesn't override national sovereignty, it informs it. And it can inform the domestic courts. They're not obliged to follow it, but if they're persuaded by the logic, perhaps they will take it into account. Essentially, therefore, the treaty allows you to formally enter a global conversation about what personhood, equality, and inclusion mean in the context of disability right around the world. The US has a lot of value to offer, but it simply cannot join that global conversation at present. The way I put it, and in fact, I produced an essay after the last time I spoke before the NFB, saying that the treaty creates a new politics of disability. It sparks advocacy for change where none has previously existed in all sorts of corners in the world, and it helps and widen advocacy for change at home, whether that's in my country or in your country or in Germany or France. Thank you so much, Mr. President. I look forward to interaction.
Thank you very much, Gerard. You know, I can't imagine anybody doing a nicer job of making us feel so good and disappointed about the same time by being off the mothership. So thank you. And really informative in terms of keeping us grounded in why this organization, we need to revisit the CRPD conversation to see if we can, again, encourage the United States Senate to provide leadership on this issue so that we can be informed by the work that's happening around the world. So thank you for your expertise.